I am going to talk today about a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. So I realized that it's very easy when thinking about speech acts and how what we do with our words contributes to injustice. One is so keen to get the message across that it's hard to see how things could get better. And this is my, I guess, my first attempt to think not only about how we do things with words, bad things, enacting injustice and perpetuating injustice, but also how we could undo some of those bad things with words as well. So that's my title, How to Undo Things with Words. Anyway, just by way of reminder about those bad things, speech acts can accommodate injustice. I've been talking about accommodation. Speech acts accommodate injustice when unjust social norms and patterns of authority feed in to illocutionary speech acts as felicity conditions. That's one aspect. And emerge as the outcome of accommodation springing into being when the speech acts require them. That's if the felicity conditions hold. So you remember, accommodation is being viewed as this very everyday process of adjustment that occurs in everyday conversations. It also occurs in ceremonial, less everyday speech acts, where somebody says something, what they say requires something to be so for it to count as correct play, and provided the conditions are in place, provided the felicity conditions are in place, hey presto, what's required comes into being. So that's the phenomenon of accommodation, and it's there in the sort of performative speech acts that Austin began with. It's there also in everyday presupposition introductions. It's there in everyday speech that uses generics. I've been talking about various sorts, and I'm not going to rehearse them all. I'm just going to begin, though, by reminding you of some of the main phenomena I've been wanting to draw attention to. So injustice is there as the among the background conditions for speech acts, providing illocutionary force that speech acts might not otherwise have. Because what you can do with words depends not only on your words and what you intend, but also on who you are, where you are in structures of hierarchy, and also about what how listeners respond to your words. One thing I've been wanting to emphasize is that the response of listeners and hearers and bystanders can be viewed as among the felicity conditions of illocutionary force. This is just a straightforward application of the phenomenon of accommodation as it's described by philosophers like Lewis and, I think, Stalnaker, though he doesn't get the whole picture. And it's also there implicitly in Austin. So I don't think it's controversial, but its normative implications, its implications for moral and political philosophy, have not been spelt out in the way I would like. So that's what I've been trying to do. So I've been talking about how unjust social norms and patterns of authority follow rules of accommodation, get distributed or get enacted through a process of accommodation. I also talked about how knowledge itself can follow rules of accommodation, not in the sense that, you know, thinking so makes it so, and you get knowledge just as easily as that. It's not that easy. But nevertheless, knowledge, or perhaps attribution of knowledge, shifts with shifting standards, with shifting stakes, and with shifting distributions of credibility. And knowledge can be gained in ways that actually reflect patterns of injustice through self-verifying or social looping speech acts. That's just to remind you of the third lecture where I was talking about knowledge. Hearers change in response to speech acts that are done with words. And these attitudinal changes constitute a different level of accommodation. So I've been arguing that we should understand accommodation at the level, at the straightway level, the level where In saying something, you are doing something at time one, at the time that you are saying something. And that corresponds to Lewis's analogy with the score of a sports game, which immediately changes. It's a normative structure that evolves over time to reflect what moves are made in the game. And of course, then downstream, later, people's attitudes change in response to those. And this accommodation at the level of attitude or psychology is not wholly independent from the former accommodation at the level of illocution. They are closely connected because when somebody asserts something, they're presenting it as to be believed or to be known, perhaps. When somebody commands something, they're presenting it as to be done. When somebody, I'm not quite sure what the illocutionary verb is that goes with present something as to be desired, then it's no coincidence that people come to desire it. And when our propaganda, for instance, Nazi propaganda we were talking about, presents people as to be hated, not, of course, as crudely as that, the mode of presentation is hugely important, then it's no coincidence that the invitation, or the sort of the invitation expressed in the illocutionary act is met by a corresponding attitude or action on the part of the hearer. So hearers change in response to those words, and both of those can be viewed as accommodation. Sorry, I don't think the actions are accommodation, but anyway, I don't want to trip myself up by getting into more detail about that here. Anyway, that was what I talked about last week. I should really have talked about it in the other order from the other thing I talked about, which is the silencing theme. Because what we do with words is enabled by background structures, just and unjust ones, of authority and credibility, which I see as a kind of authority, background social norms, background facts about what hearers and bystanders are going to expect and what they actually do, whether they intervene or not, whether they block our presuppositions. The other side of that is that when the conditions are not right, when the conditions are not in play, then there can be illocutionary disablement. There can be silencing, which is when you have your words and they don't have the illocutionary force that you intend them to have. And I've argued elsewhere, and I argued briefly here, that some kinds of speech are silenced in exactly this way. For instance, speech acts of sexual refusal might be silenced in this way. I talked about that. But I also talked about many, many other handicaps that fall short of illocutionary silencing, illocutionary disablement, where it's much more to do with the handicaps or disincentives to block them. These involve the way that presupposition works in an under the radar way. Difficult to notice. There are epistemological problems with backdoor speech acts. I talked about those. There are normative problems when it seems like bad manners to interrupt or block what someone's presupposing, because you are shifting the focus away from what they're wanting to draw attention to and moving it elsewhere. I'm not going to remind you of all of those barriers, but these are barriers, both normative and epistemic, that make it hard to answer bad speech with good speech. Now, I want to remind you why we were interested in that question in the first place. Recall what Brandeis said. Two courageous, self-reliant men with confidence in the power of free and fearless reasoning, this is quotation one, applied through the processes of popular government, no danger flowing from speech can be deemed clear and present unless the incidence of the evil apprehended is so imminent that it may befall before there is opportunity for full discussion. If there be time to expose through discussion the falsehood and fallacies, to avert the evil by the processes of education, the remedy to be applied is more speech, not enforced silence. You know, that's a really wonderful speech, and I'm embarrassed in a way, in retrospect, that I contradict it contradicted it so roundly in my very first lecture when I said wrong, 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 I was it 5 or 6 times in a row, wrong about what speech is, wrong about what it would take to correct the falsehoods and fallacies, wrong about whether falsehoods and fallacies were the only problems. Anyway, now I want to go back to Brandeis and see if we can find a way to make him right. So, one thing that you could do is to notice the little if in what he said. So what he said was, you know, if there be time, etc., etc. So perhaps you could, so obviously ordinary uses of if in ordinary conversation, you know, it takes a lot of interpretation to see what's being meant. Let's at least explore the thought that he meant it like this. He meant it as an injunction to avoid enforced silence, to avoid the enforced silence of harmful speech. Avoid that enforced silence just as long as those conditions hold, just in case those conditions hold. So what's needed is for those conditions to hold if we're going to avoid enforced silence. I think that's a decent interpretation of what he said. It's true that he also assumed that all those conditions are in place. So he thought that was no problem. He thought that all those conditions were in place, but there is a problem. The problem is that the conditions don't hold. The conditions that he was describing for the answering of bad speech with good speech don't hold. And in a way, all of the preceding lectures have been devoted to the question, let's have a look at why these conditions don't hold. So, what do we do about that? Well, one conclusion might be, okay, well, sorry, we have to go for the enforced silence. We have to enforce the silence of bad speech. And that is exactly what campaigners against hate speech and pornography, for example, who say it needs to be censored or it needs to be made civilly actionable or it needs to be restricted by law in different ways, that is exactly what they're arguing for. In the situation where these conditions don't hold, then there is no argument against the silencing of this speech. And I think that is one real possibility, especially for certain sorts of extreme speech. And I have talked about that in other work, and I'm not going to talk about it more today. So I think that it would be justified, but I'm not going to talk about it more. Of course, the other option is create the conditions. So basically, if he says avoid the enforced silence just in case the conditions hold, and if the conditions don't hold, then either go for enforced silence or create the conditions. Treat it as a practical injunction to create the conditions. So this is how I am agreeing with Brandeis. Okay, so you'll see that this is a kind of reverse engineering of Brandeis. Okay. If the remedy to be applied is not enforced silence, then what? Enable the exposure through discussion of falsehood and fallacies. Enable the averting of evil by the processes of education. And since, as we said, not everything is a matter of falsehood and fallacies, we might need to find other ways to combat unjust speech, by which I mean speech acts that can't be, that's not, the problem isn't just that it's false. In fact, we've been looking at unjust true speech, speech that in fact engenders knowledge of a bad sort. So the problem isn't just falsehoods and fallacies, the problem is the can sometimes be the enactment or setting of norms that then have a self-fulfilling aspect through social looping effects and the like. There will be things that you can't simply combat through education, and I'm not quite sure how we combat those. Now, if we're thinking about how to create the conditions, my next question is, how can the picture that I've been exploring here, that I've been arguing for here, how can that picture be drawn upon to shed light on what the conditions might be? What conditions would help? What conditions would enable the fighting of bad speech with good? So you see, I'm trying to be on the same team as Brandeis now. Okay. One side of the picture that I've been arguing for here is that doing things with words is a matter of doing things together with words. By that, I don't necessarily mean a matter of collective intention. In fact, I've been minimizing the role of intention in speech acts through these lectures. But nevertheless, the capacity to speak, so looking at speech, the capacity to speak involves being able to do things with words, understood not just as a power to make meaningful noises or utter true sentences, not a matter of what Austin called mere locution, but a substantial capacity to perform speech acts. Now, this might take concrete economic and educational resources and contributions from parties other than the speaker. So what I'm doing just now is I'm just going to pull out three features from the picture that I've been exploring here that are going to be relevant to practical remedies. I have to say that what I'm going to say in this lecture is extremely programmatic. It's extremely programmatic, but it's also extremely sort of hostage to empirical fortune. But I take that as a plus rather than a minus, because one of the things I think is really important when we're thinking about conditions for the enablement of speech is that they are not conditions that can simply be settled from the armchair, from the philosopher's armchair. So I think that this area of political philosophy is ripe for, you know, a bit of evidence-based theorizing. You know, we've had evidence-based theorizing in many other bits of philosophy, in moral psychology, in philosophy of mind, in ethics, reasoning, sort of quick and hasty methods of reasoning and other methods. So there are ways in which the conditions for speech are not simply to be settled from the philosopher's armchair. And one problem, I think, is that much theorizing about free speech has worked from an utterly abstract point of view with agents who are philosophers' ideals, who resemble very poorly the actual agents that we encounter in each other in the social world we live in. So I'm not going to apologize for this part being programmatic and hostage to various bits of empirical fortune. So first thing then is a conception of speech that involves speech as going beyond mere locution, as more than uttering meaningful words. And this is something that Jennifer Hornsby has written a great deal about, and I have written about elsewhere, Carolyn West as well. So, second point then, spelling this out, it involves hearers and bystanders and other people as well, other agents as well. So speech acts are accommodated in part by the attitudes, acts, and omissions of other parties. So recall that if you accept what I said about the pattern for accommodation, then you will accept that among the felicity conditions for certain speech acts are not only background authority structures and norms, not only sometimes the intentions of speakers, not only the words they use, but the attitudes and acts and omissions as well of hearers. One place that this happens is in speech acts that are done in backdoor ways, for example, through presupposition introduction. Lewis's example, even George could win. Nobody jumps in and says, what do you mean, even? That speech act adds to the score that George is an unpromising candidate. Also, from an Austinian point of view, enacts a verdictive, ranking George as inferior. And that felicity condition is the omission of hearers. It's the failure of hearers at a later time to block the presupposition, and that condition at a later time is an absence that is all the same, a felicity condition for what happened at an earlier time. Remember I said, yes, this looks like a weird metaphysical picture of illocutionary force because its conditions are not just in the background in the past, its conditions are also in the future. And I just said, I'm going to bite that bullet, and I don't think it is a bullet anyway, so I don't mind biting it. The acts and omissions of hearers are relevant, and this has implications then for the responsibility of other parties, ordinary hearers and bystanders and institutions and others, all of whom we can now understand as fellow actors in what speakers do with words. Now, I'm not going to say the implausible thing that, you know, the bystanders and so forth are just as responsible as the speaker, especially the speaker uttering the words intentionally. But nevertheless, they do have a role, and I haven't, you know, I'm not going to quantify exactly what the role is. That creates responsibilities. What sort of responsibility? Moral responsibility? Causal responsibility? None of these quite fit the bill. So this is a very exploratory bit of this project, and I really welcome comments on it. I'm going to get to the sort of responsibility it is and the extent to which it is a moral responsibility in just a moment. Just to allay any misgivings that you might be having, I'm not going to announce a new categorical imperative which requires each person at every point to block a false presupposition whenever they hear it. That would be too much. Life is too short and too complicated. What to do in place of that novel categorical imperative is sort of unfinished business, which I'll get to in just a minute. Okay. It's not just the hearers and bystanders, sort of people more remote than that. Suppose there are speakers at an even more remote level who contribute to conversation by poisoning the hearers' minds. So I talked about Nazi propaganda, where Jewish people were portrayed as the poisonous toadstool, which looked indistinguishable from the good ones. But what it meant was whatever the Jewish person said, you couldn't believe it. And I talked about how that undermining of credibility, itself a species of testimonial injustice in Miranda Fricker's framework, that is an interference in speech that goes from the speaker of propaganda to some hearers, poisoning their mind. The metaphor of poison reminded me of the ongoing metaphor of poison in Othello, which I've been reading recently for some reason. Anyway, where Iago is constantly describing his own words as poison. I will pour this pestilence into his ear, into Othello's ear, and having poisoned him anyway. And the poison, and there too, the pestilence that's poured into Othello's ear amounts to a poisoning of Othello's perception of what Desdemona is saying. So it works like the propaganda in undermining the credibility and the force of what the target says in ways that silence her or silence the Jewish people, or the other example I talked about, silence the woman who is trying to say no. Silence through at this rather remote level, because there's the speaker over there poisoning the hearer over here, with the outcome being the silence of another party over here. So the responsibility in this picture is really very, it really extends very far. So I've been talking about speech, a richer conception of speech, hearers, bystanders, and others, and now I want to say something about knowledge. One thing I've been wanting to emphasize is that there's been, in some ways, too much focus on speech as the vehicle for knowledge, in the sense that it's been assumed that the goal of speech always is the transmission of knowledge. And I quoted Bob Stalnaker in this connection. I quoted John Stuart Mill in this connection. But I actually do think that knowledge is important. And by knowledge, I have in mind ordinary, receptive knowledge, not the rather more sinister sort of knowledge that I talked about under the heading of maker's knowledge that oppressors have of the outcome of their oppression. So, and in this connection, asserting or telling is a particularly significant sort of speech act. It's often been said by people working on assertion and perhaps people working on telling. I mean, Jane Hornsby prefers to think of the illocutionary force as that of telling, because that sort of brings in the hearer in a way that assertion doesn't. But many people say that knowledge is a norm for assertion. And what I argued in the lecture on knowledge was that if that's at all plausible, we should also think that knowledge is a norm for not just assertion and not just telling, but every knowledge-oriented speech act. What do I mean by knowledge-oriented speech acts? Speech acts that are a routine means for the transmission of knowledge, whether we mean them to be or not. They involve implicit speech acts. They involve speech acts that are done even in the context of fiction operators. So even George Could Win, that speech act we were talking about before, the speaker should know that George could win, and the speaker should know that George is an unpromising candidate. If you're supposed to know what you assert, you should also know what you presuppose. Fiction, why should you know stuff in fiction? Because part of fiction can be fact or can be purported fact. I'm talking, and this is, I think, bread and butter of theory of truth in fiction. It's there in Lewis in his paper on that title, that part of fiction is a factual or purported factual backdrop, the geography of London in the Sherlock Holmes stories, and their biology of snakes in the Sherlock Holmes stories. Yeah, Conan Doyle should have got it right on the biology of snakes, and he didn't. Okay, so you can, as good as lie, I don't know whether to call it a lie, you can as good as lie through what you presuppose and through what you convey through the purported facts that's the backdrop of fiction, just as surely as you can through what you explicitly assert. That's what I argued before. So this means that speakers are responsible in a way that we don't normally take ourselves to be. I'll get to more about that in a moment. That's about individual responsibility. It's also relevant to wider issues about free speech. Knowledge as a norm for free speech, that was there in Mill. If we take the rationale for free speech being the argument from truth, which, as I said before, is really an argument from knowledge. We need free speech because freedom of opinion and of the expression of opinion is something that, which if we don't have, we'll lose some truths. And if we don't lose truths, we will lose the conviction and rational basis for the truths that we have. So basically, he's concerned that we need free speech for knowledge. For those of you who need a reminder of the argument from truth and need to decide that it really is about knowledge, it's quoted on 2 on the handout. So, if you think this is important, then you will think that certain sorts of speech are going to matter more when it comes to free speech. A political counterpart to the norm that I just described for individuals might be something about protecting speech only if it's knowledge promoting. That would be way too strong for reasons I'm not going to go into here. But it's connected with something that is genuinely important that I don't have time to get into here, which is that speech acts that are doing something completely different, you know, enacting your child's bedtime or whatever like that. This is not an exercise of free speech, and that's there in the arguments of Kent Greenewalt and Mary-Kate McGowan and Ashani Mitra, who have argued that situation-altering or significantly norm-enacting speech acts are not covered by a free speech principle. So that would tie in closely with the idea that what free speech principles are about is fundamentally knowledge. So that would go with a million story about the point of free speech. So there's one other role for knowledge, but I'm going to postpone it until I get to responsibilities for our institutions. Okay, now I said this is going to be programmatic, and I'm sorry if this is going to seem like a rag bag of different strategies, but these are all strategies that I find hugely interesting and in many cases really promising. And they illustrate what it might mean to give concrete reality to Brandeis's thought that we need something that is going to make the conditions for free speech real, because that's the only alternative to enforced silence. So I'm going to divide it between responsibilities on the part of institutions and those on the part of individuals. So, and I'm going to draw on the things I just said pulled out of this picture. The richer picture of speech, the responsibilities of bystanders and others, the role of knowledge and the like. Okay, so responsibility for omissions. Why might that be relevant if you're thinking of institutions, for instance, the state? So doing nothing as a hearer or bystander can be doing something. This raises the possibility that state non-interference in unjust speech can be a failure to block that grants it additional illocutionary force. This is something that's implicit in Ishani Maitre's work on subordinating speech that we began with. Recall her example, one example was the hate speaker who burns a cross. We don't know who the hate speaker is, and the community leaders do nothing. The omissions of the community leaders, in her view, give that speech a derived illocutionary force that might enable it to be subordination, which it would otherwise lack. And she argues for that conclusion on the basis of analogies of other very plausible cases where the omissions of certain authority figures, even if they're not explicit endorsements, count as failures to block. She doesn't put it in terms of failures to block, but I am. So they count as failures to block, which give the speech force it would otherwise lack. And I'm just suggesting in an only half-teasing way that we can capture this as a kind of injunction to remove the state subsidies for hate speech and the state subsidies for other unjust speech. Why is that a state subsidy? Well, this is an admittedly obsolete meaning of subsidy, and here it is from the OED. A subsidy, help, aid, or assistance, from the Latin sub and sedere, meaning sitting under. So it's state support. And I really like that way of putting it, even though I know it's extremely, I wouldn't be surprised if nobody else in this room would like that way of putting it. I like that way of putting it because the argument here has been that omissions can be support. Omissions can be felicity conditions for illocutionary force, and that's why state silence, state omissions, can be a state subsidy of hate speech. Anyway, I don't know if I would be reported as saying state tolerance is a state subsidy of hate speech. I do think this is a genuine phenomenon. So if you look at how hate speakers and pornographers invoke the First Amendment in a spirit of righteousness, I think that it's definitely drawing on it as the school bully in Maitre's example draws on the teacher's omissions as a source of support. Okay, so that omission could be ameliorated. Of course, one way to do it would be to enact laws that would penalize such speech, but alternatively, something could be done not through legal constraint, but through communicative means. I'm really interested in the question of whether the state and other institutions, including universities and many other institutions, have a role as not merely practical authorities, which is the one that's always focused on, but also epistemic authorities. I'll say more about that in just a minute, because these thoughts are all connected. So, one thought that would be building on this richer conception of speech would be to see it in terms that draw on Nussbaum and Sen, the idea that certain important liberties and interests have to be understood in terms of a capability. This idea of a capability approach to speech is being explored. It was explored by Susan Bryson, and it's being explored further and argued for by Catherine Gelber. What it means is that concrete economic and educational resources are needed for the exercise of speech. So the intuitive thought is there's a certain kind of hypocrisy in the idea that you're giving someone free speech if you're simply letting them say something in an isolated room, not to anybody else. So, you know, Robinson Crusoe hasn't got free speech. That's the thought. Free speech takes other resources. This is often thought of as a positive liberty conception of free speech, which raises a lot of issues that I don't have time to defend here. But there's something very hypocritical, in my view, about states who say they prize free speech and go on about it at great length and then do not pay their dues to the UN and other international bodies to enable world efforts at literacy. The idea that you only care about speech if a government is going to crack down on it, you haven't got free speech if you are at home and you can't read anything. So literacy is the basic part of speech. So I'm sympathetic to the idea of speech as a capability approach to free speech. So I'm gesturing in that direction. Like I say, this is very, very programmatic, and those who are interested, I really encourage you to look at some of the work I just mentioned. So one other idea that's there in Catherine Gelber's work is that the state could act in a speech-enhancing way, not only by providing resources of the kind I just mentioned, seeing speech as something that needs concrete and educational resources, but also providing different opportunities to speak. So she argues that rather than banning hate speech, this state should provide resources for the targets of hate speech to answer back. Those resources include platforms, public platforms, enabling platforms, which do take financial resources. So this is obviously relevant to wider issues about epistemological epistemic injustice too, by the way. So I will just flag that. So there are many, many other things that you could do. I mentioned already the priority to knowledge-oriented speech. That seems to fall out of it. There are other things that one could do other than other legal constraint option. One thing that many have suggested with regard to certain sorts of speech is that there's something odd about having an opt-out approach where you have to see it unless you opt out. So this connects with wider views about whether nudge approaches, as described by Cass Sunstein and others, have a role to play when it comes to free speech? Could things be set up in such a way that it is that the speech is permitted, but it's not so much in your face? You have to opt in to get it rather than opting out. I understand that South Africa had a law that could be understood in that way. I heard from someone, an expert on that yesterday. Anyway, I'm not sure whether it should be understood that way, but anyway. Okay, so there could be institutional structures, not just laws, but on the part of institutions like universities and employers and so forth, to guard against unjust distributions of authority. And here we have issues about anonymity, you know, orchestras doing their making sure the auditions are done behind a screen, what that did for the increased number of women in orchestras. I think everybody knows about that. In the context of universities, anonymity as a way to counteract the effect of unjust distributions of authority, otherwise known as implicit bias, a topic that's been getting a lot of attention lately. Now, in all of these strategies, one thing of interest and possible promise is to think of the state not only as a practical authority enacting rules, but as an epistemic authority, in part on its own rules. And now this brings me to the topic I left out before. Suppose that justice requires knowledge of what justice requires. I'll say that again because it's an idea that I'm drawing from Jeremy Waldron's book about hate speech. The thought is that you don't have justice if the laws are there protecting you, giving you civil standing, giving you civil rights, but you don't know about them. So imagine that apartheid law was abolished in South Africa and nobody publicized that fact. Nobody told anybody. No black person would vote because they wouldn't know about it. So that would be an extreme case where it's completely obvious that with civil standing comes knowledge of civil standing. What I mean is, in order to have the civil standing, you require not only the laws to be in place, but the people to know what their rights and their standing is. One place that this matters, right here, not in old apartheid South Africa, but right here, is the mismatch between legal norms on sexual violence and social norms on sexual violence. This is a topic in Les Green's paper that I mentioned before, Should the Law Improve Morality? It's a very interesting paper where he talks about how the law has improved morality in various ways already, especially about the standing of gay people. And the law could improve morality in a place where morality is in a very bad way. And he has in mind sexual morality. And he has in mind precisely the thing that is bothering me just now, which is the mismatch between sexual norms as they are held, for example, by the high school students that I described, that were interviewed in the Children's Commissioner's report that I quoted from in an earlier lecture, and what the law says. You know, this week I actually wrote to the authorities who publish the law online. And by the law, what I have in mind is the Sexual Offences Act of 2003. And I said, can you please tell me where I can find a plain English version of this piece of legislation accessible to high school students? And they wrote back and said, I'm sorry, we know nothing about any plain English version of this legislation. So I wrote back and said, well, can you tell me who could help me find out whether there's a plain English version? And they directed me to an obscure bit, and I still couldn't find it. Anyway, so what we have, I believe, is a situation where the law endorses certain norms about consent. Someone doesn't consent if they do not have the power to consent, for example, because they are completely drunk. That is not in the public perception of consent. That's just one area. People, anyway, I won't go on and on about this. This is one area where I think it is very obvious, and I agree with Les Green on this, that there is a huge mismatch between the social norms about sex and what even the law requires. And of course, I think the law should be improved, but that's another issue. And here, one of the basic things is, women, and I'm thinking especially of vulnerable women, young women, high school women, who are in the grip of sort of blame the victim myths and in the grip of all sorts of falsehoods about what does and doesn't count as asking for it. They are in something analogous to the situation of someone under apartheid law who has their civil standing and doesn't know it yet. The onus is on the state to communicate what it has required. So that's one suggestion. That's a communicative function. And what it puts on the table is the thought that there is a neglected epistemological aspect to justice. And by that, I don't just mean epistemic injustice of the sort that Miranda Fricker has talked about so eloquently and many other social epistemologists. I'm talking about a straightforward bit of political philosophy which says, regardless of social epistemology, you don't have your political rights unless you know what they are. This is an idea that Waldron argues for, arguing that hate speech undermines knowledge. Hate speech undermines knowledge of someone's, of the target's civil standing. That's the thought. And I talked about this earlier in the lecture on knowledge, talking about how the hate speaker has a role a little bit like the skeptic in the contextualist picture of knowledge, whose utterances make the knowledge go away. So, and there we have a particular sort of knowledge, the knowledge of what justice requires. So, I've been talking about the importance of knowledge and of speech as a wider capacity. Now I want to talk about individuals. There's so much more to say about institutions, and this is so programmatic and gestural, but anyway, never mind, here goes. Now turning to individuals. I said I wasn't going to enunciate a new categorical imperative. However, there is going to be a slight Kantian flavour, I warn you. Okay. Okay. The first thing I want to say, and this is something I mentioned already, is that for individuals, there is maybe an unnoted responsibility for what I've been calling backdoor speech acts. Backdoor speech acts that are enacted through backdoor methods such as presupposition, backgrounds of fiction, backgrounds of presuppositions of things that aren't even assertions, questions, many backdoor speech acts, and I've been riding roughshod over a whole lot of distinctions about implicature and pragmatic presupposition and semantic presupposition that if I were able to talk through with my philosopher of language friends, I would be able to get a lot tighter. Okay, but so backdoor speech acts are speech acts that we are responsible for. And first of all, that means being responsible for them when they might not be the speech act we were thinking they were. So remember the discussion of generics. Generics are a wonderful case where we use words meaning to do something with them. We're not exactly sure what. We're very ready to find them true on the basis of very few instances. And we're very ready to shift from one disambiguation of them, the striking property version, to the statistical version, to the characteristic version, maybe to the normative version. You know, which of these is, you know, the boys don't cry? You know, is this supposed to be a statistical generalization? Is it supposed to be a normative statement? And generics, I think I agree with Sarah Jane Leslie, are a potent means for the transmission of social norms. And speakers who use generics need to take responsibility for them and make clear which sort they mean. So that's one sort. That's one instance. Because the Speech Act might be a statistical generalization, or it might be something else. And if it's a normative generic, then it's doing something completely different. And its standards for success are different. And again, you shouldn't say it unless you know it. So that's the other thing. You should take responsibility for the other sorts of speech acts that might be going on, and for the truth of whatever it is you're conveying through the backdoor speech acts. So that's responsibility for backdoor speech acts. Responsibility for omissions. This is for hearers and bystanders. If doing nothing can be doing something, then failing to block assumptions that enact norms and authority patterns is an omission that is, you know, bad. It's contributing to something bad. What sort of responsibility? Okay, I'm going to get to that in just a minute. Now, in thinking about what is required of individuals, you know, this is a really tough question, and I am really not quite sure how to approach it. I'm inspired by what Miranda Fricker has done in her work on epistemic injustice, where she said in her book that, where she argued that the important way to combat testimonial injustice, that's, remember, the testimonial injustice is the unjust distribution of credibility, it involves acquiring or building certain sorts of epistemic virtues. She calls it the virtue of testimonial justice. So to combat testimonial injustice, you need to acquire the virtue of testimonial justice. Now, I'm not going to do justice to what she is what she wants to say there, but what I think is important about that strategy is there is a mixture of epistemic and practical virtues that are not the whole story, but they are maybe part of the story. What I mean is they are not the whole answer, but they are part of the answer. They are not the whole answer, and this is something I said in response to Miranda in a review, because, you know, very often you just can't manage to get the virtues that are required. It's just too hard to acquire the virtue of testimonial justice. And what we need, actually, are just straightforward mechanical institutional structures like, you know, anonymous refereeing and so forth that will help combat the problems much better. But nevertheless, I do think there's something right that in the thought that there is something individual people can do. Now, I said there would be a Kantian flavor to this. There's a Kantian flavor because virtues in the Kantian picture, I'm afraid to say, are merely a means to an end. We haven't got the Aristotelian picture from the Kantian perspective that says, you know, the good life is all about acquiring virtue. Virtues are a means to an end, and the end is doing the right thing. So in the Doctrine of Virtue, Kant talks about how we need to build the strength, the power, to obey the categorical imperative. Now, I said I wasn't going to announce a new categorical imperative. What I really should have said is I'm not going to announce a perfect duty, a categorical imperative that has the form of a perfect duty, which is like the duty always to tell the truth, which, of course, we should obey. What do we have instead? It's going to have the character of an imperfect duty. Unfortunately, an imperfect duty is very hard to get clear on. But what is an imperfect duty? Kant brings in the idea of an imperfect duty to as a way to understand our duties to be benevolent, our duties to make the ends of others our own. So he does think it matters to not only refrain from telling lies, fulfilling our perfect duties, but making the ends of others our own. The happiness of others, that's something we should pursue. But we shouldn't pursue it in the way a utilitarian would pursue it. We shouldn't say, well, let's get as much of it as we can. Let's promote, let's maximize happiness. No, instead, it's an imperfect duty that has a certain sort of lassitude about it. You need to make the ends of others your own. You need to make your ends coincide with others and help people. To a certain degree, enough. And if you never did that, you would be failing in your imperfect duty of benevolence. But for any given opportunity to be benevolent, maybe you don't have to do it. And then Kant scholars say, well, what about, you know, extreme circumstances? Is there a duty of rescue if something's really extreme? Yeah, maybe the extremity of the need doesn't make a difference. Why is that a good model for the virtue that I have in mind here? What I'm thinking of is the virtue, which I haven't worked out how to name. The virtue, first of all, has got an epistemic side and a practical side. The epistemic side is basically about being alert. It's about being alert to all of that incredibly tricky and really interesting backdoor stuff that is going on when we're using our words to do stuff that we don't even mean to be doing. It's being alert to it as a speaker, being alert to it as a hearer, trying to stop it just sort of sliding through under the radar. The under the radar part was one of the main problems that I tried to identify when talking about the handicaps on fighting bad speech with good. So part of the virtue is going to be an epistemic virtue about noticing certain stuff, paying attention, if you like. You know, Iris Murdoch made a big deal out of paying attention to people, but I'm talking about the normative significance of paying attention to certain aspects of speech. And then there's a practical part, which involves you know, having the nous to jump in and say, hey, what do you mean, even George? Or having the nous to say, hey, I don't think we talk like that around here, or some much, much wittier comeback. And as you know, my Aristotelian role model, because I do like Aristotle for some bits, is the quick-thinking Tina Fey. B is the other thing I agree with that comes from Aristotle, which is that it's not at all easy. So Kant thought it was incredibly easy to do the right thing. I mean, I know lying to the murderer at the door, telling the truth to the murderer at the door doesn't sound easy, but still, nevertheless, there's a sense in which it's really easy for Kant, because it's just a matter of having a good will. There's a way in which he certainly proclaims his moral philosophy as being very easy. It's supposed to be really democratic. Anyone can simply see what the right thing to do is. They just need to think whether they can universalize their maxim, and boom, they know whether it's an okay thing to do or not. Now, I agree with Aristotle that actually a huge amount goes into the good life and the virtuous life, even if we understand virtue in Kantian terms. It takes skill, it takes resources, it takes a huge amount, and it's really hard. And it's also, you can't possibly do it all the time. Life is way too short, way too complicated. We've got so many other things in life that we are juggling that I'm not going to say, well, here's a new perfect duty. Always block the false presupposition. Be armed to the teeth. There's this bit where Kant says, you know, he talks about the moral philosophies that he doesn't like, where your path is bristling with duties at every step. You know, this would really create a path that was bristling with duties at every step. That is not reasonable. So that's why I'm suggesting we think of it as an imperfect duty. What that means, by the way, is that for any given instance of not interfering, we're not going to be in the business of blaming for that bit of non-interfering. I mean, maybe if it's a duty of rescue case, maybe if it's something so appalling, by the way, like some of the appalling stories that are on, you know, what it's like to be a woman in philosophy. I'm sure most people here have looked at that blog, and the incredible and shocking stories about things that were said that were then accompanied by nervous laughter when they should have been accompanied by stony silence, which in response to the sort of joke that was told, Jenny Saul's written about this, stony silence can be a blocking of a really awful joke. Anyway, It could also make you look like a... Anyway, I've talked about the challenges with all of these methods of blocking. Anyway, so there's the epistemic side, there's the practical side, if it's an imperfect, if it's a power to perform an imperfect duty, to develop the skill and recognitional capacities as well as the, the nous and guts or whatever else it takes to jump in and intervene in a really wise and sensible way, because, you know, there are all sorts of ways in which it might backfire and go wrong, then that's something that is worth developing and worth enabling, and that itself is going to take resources, and there are different ways that might be pursued. And I said no blame. No blame for the specific instance, because in general with an imperfect duty you're not blameworthy for neglecting one particular bit, one particular occasion for charity. And here too you're not blameworthy for neglecting one particular opportunity to intervene. But then again, wider issues of blame might be at stake here, and I'm interested in the connection between this thought and Hannah Pickard's thought that we can think of responsibility in a forward-looking way where we're leaving behind the issue of blame for the past. This is not the same as an imperfect duty, but it is an issue which she describes as the responsibility without blame model, which is especially important in the therapeutic context or the context of offenders, where what's important is people taking themselves to be taking responsibility for what is going to happen, without everybody getting into the business of what a terrible thing you did in the past. So, of course, there's a consequentialist flavour to that which Kant would not have liked. Okay, so I've run out of time. I want to say one more thing, which also has an Aristotelian flavour. I said that the force of speech can depend on stuff that the hearers and bystanders contribute. One thing that bystanders can contribute is, you know, the blocking of really awful hate speech, like the sort that was on the train that Ishani Maitra describes. Another thing that hearers could do, if they're incredibly clever, is shift an ambiguous speech act in a particular direction, which amounts to defusing it. You know, generics might be a great case of that, because they're already so blurry. So one thing, you know, you could do the challenging thing and say, well, do you mean generic A, B, C, or D? Or you could say, oh, right, yeah, I see what you mean. You, it's like, anyway, so there's a, there might be a way to interpret it in a defusing way. And if you're doing it like that, then the hearer and the bystander is literally changing the illocutionary force of the speaker, actually contrary to what the speaker intended. Of course, that's very subversive, and it sounds this is my bit that sounds sort of like Judith Butler, I guess. I wish, anyway. Okay, so but I want to say as one last thought, and this is the Aristotelian thought, somebody who might have done something bad and ends up not doing something bad through good luck has a piece of moral luck. Remember, I talked about moral luck early on as a model for the ontology of speech acts. Whether Gauguin did the right thing in abandoning his family depends on whether he turned out to be a great painter. That's a cartoon version of William's thought in his paper on moral luck. Now, so we have someone uttering bad hate speech, or what could have been bad hate speech, and some incredibly clever and wise hearer, I don't know who it could be, manages to shift it so it's not bad. Or they manage to maybe just block it so it is bad, but it doesn't have the bad effects that it would have had if it was more authoritative. So there are things that hearers can do to reduce the badness of speakers' actions, and when they do, when we do that, if we can do that, then that is giving ourselves a certain... Anyway, that is doing something which I think hasn't really been described in the literature on moral luck, we ourselves are being the sources of moral luck for each other. I think that is a really inspiring thought, actually. I wish more people would be sources of moral luck for me, because I certainly need it. And on that hopeful note, let me close. Thank you.